Welcome to British History, Royals, Rebels, and Romantics, a fortnightly podcast where we look at some of our favorite royals, rebels, and romantics of British history. Now sit back and enjoy as we shake up history together. Welcome, everyone. I am delighted to welcome you to another episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics, and I'm thrilled to have Dr. Valerie Shute with us to talk about a time in history. You know, as soon as we got on the phone together or on Zoom together, we immediately jumped in. So I thought, oh, no, let's start the record. And so we can share with you this fascinating time in history when there were a couple of queens vying for the throne. It's so interesting, both women, of course. The Tudors may be not so good at having sons. But anyway, thank you for joining us. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to your deep study of Mary Tudor.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and talk about the queens with you today. I am Valerie Shute, like she mentioned. I am an independent historian, which means I don't work with a university. I don't teach. I actually currently homeschool my son, so I am teaching, but just not quite Tudor history. So I have been working on Tudor queens for a while now, and I kind of approached them when I was doing my undergrad and trying to figure out what I wanted to go to grad school for, and came across a book on Anne Boleyn, and that kind of changed everything. So since then, I haven't worked on Anne Boleyn too much, and it seems like there's a lot of good work coming out on her now, so I don't really ever plan to, but that's how I got interested in the Tudors.
Well, a lot of us fall into the Tudors in different ways, but then find there's an endless number, especially, I think, of fascinating women to pursue.
Yes.
The kings are interesting, but the women are just so complex and so multifaceted. And we are going to talk about a couple of those women today, and not only in their own time, but one of the really fascinating things is some of your recent work looks at a Victorian perspective of the time of Jane Grey and Mary Tudor, and that July period where both women are vying for the throne, not only through the eyes of the time, but also through Victorian eyes. And I think, interestingly, that affects how we see it today. So tell me a little bit about, I'm just going to pull out some of the characters and you can elaborate for us.
Sure.
One is Edward Underhill. He's a really interesting voice at this time. So tell us a bit about him.
Sure. Edward Underhill was a gentleman pensioner under Henry VIII, Edward VI, and Mary. So basically, he was a part of the royal bodyguard. Now, at the time, his nickname was the Hot Gospeler. So he was like a super Protestant. And he had a reputation for preaching to some of the other pensioners, which is how he got his nickname. So at Mary's accession, he was actually arrested and taken to the Tower where the Privy Council was. And he was arrested for writing a ballad. And they questioned him about this ballad. And there were all kinds of ballads printed at the time of Mary's accession, but this one doesn't exist anymore. So he gets arrested for writing this ballad, and we don't know what it says, but he says to the Privy Council, "I didn't say anything bad about Mary. I just said bad stuff about Catholicism." And that's really important because at the time of Mary's accession, there wasn't lots of negative things being said about Mary herself. It was much more geared to anti-Catholic sentiment, not anti-Mary sentiment. So he kind of falls in line with a bigger discussion going on at the time. So the Privy Council isn't quite sure what to do with him. They don't want rebellions to start and stuff like just what happened that Mary experienced with Jane. So they sent him to Newgate Prison. So he goes to Newgate Prison for a month. While he's there, his wife gives birth to one of their sons. They have lots of children. And she names their son Guildford, after Guildford Dudley, husband of Lady Jane Grey. So when he gets out of prison, he ends up serving Mary again as a gentleman pensioner. And he works, he serves at her wedding, and he serves guarding her person against Wyatt's rebellion. And then in 1561, he writes a memoir. So I got into Edward Underhill because I was looking at, I started, this whole project was convoluted, but came back because I was trying to find these ballads that were written at Mary's accession. And I came across how he got arrested for his ballad. And we only know this because of his 1561 memoir, where he talks about his time under Mary and then very briefly under Elizabeth.
Okay. Okay. So as he tells his story, how does his he describe his allegiance to Mary, to Elizabeth, and prior to that, Edward and Henry VIII? I mean, he had a long history with the Tudors.
He had a long history. And I think that's really important to remember, is sometimes when we look back at this time, we think of things being pitted as Protestant versus Catholic. And I think Edward Underhill is a really interesting example of a man, of a court servant, of a crown servant, who made his living serving the monarchy. And he was known to be a Protestant, but he very happily served under Mary, and he knew that she was not. And it, to me, he's an example of one person, and I'm certain if we would look, we'd find many, many, many who were loyal to the monarchy, really no matter what. I mean, that was their job. And he served the crown, he knew that was his purpose. And at that point, the monarch's personal religion didn't affect his ability to do his job.
And that's really interesting, because the religion was important, but it was not the only thing that was important.
Exactly.
And he's a great example of that. And we do see some people who survive through different reigns and continue their service. You know, in a similar way, some of the women who served several of Henry VIII's wives, as he's changing wives, we see some of the women serving wife after wife after wife. Their role is to serve the consort, whoever that might be.
Exactly. Those ladies in waiting are similar. There's lots of other employees who did the same thing. There's lots of, I typically study book dedications, and I find it interesting when I can read books that were given to Henry VIII, to Edward, to Mary and Elizabeth, all written by the same person. And I know that that person was either Protestant or Catholic, but you know, went on to serve each of those monarchs or write or translate for them anyway, because the religion was only one aspect of their job, of their life, of the way that they interacted with the monarchy.
Right. And that sometimes that loyalty to Mary as the heir, that's one of the things you and I were speaking about earlier, loyalty to Mary as the daughter of Henry VIII, whatever her legitimacy status was technically, loyalty to her as the daughter of Henry VIII, which, you know, there were a few people at Edward's final days that did not realize the depth of that loyalty to Mary. And yes, it's just interesting that they thought the religion would take the primary role, and it doesn't always.
Exactly. I really think that is something that is so interesting about that time, is that in London, there was some kind of assumption that if you supported Jane, you know, Protestantism would take over and everybody would kind, you know, it'd be very easy to defeat Mary in a way. And, you know, looking back at that now, you can see that, again, religion was only one little sliver of that. Gender was only one little sliver of that. Right. And it had more so to do with Mary as the daughter of Henry VIII, and who for 20 years was recognized essentially as the Princess of Wales.
Right.
You know, so she had a big following, and to displace her and even Elizabeth with somebody who was their cousin when his children still were, you know, alive and able to reign, it just didn't work.
It didn't work. And it is a fascinating moment. And again, it's also interesting that as hard as Edward looked, he could not find any male heirs to try. So he was, you know, it's these women that we're looking at, Mary and Jane and Elizabeth, as that picture of, you know, sort of who's next on the throne.
At Edward's death, the next eight people in line for the throne were women. I mean, he had nowhere to turn.
Yes.
You know, he even tried in his device, like, well, maybe Frances Grey will have a boy. You know, well, right, she wasn't having more kids. So I guess maybe Jane Grey will have a boy. And then, you know, she was a teenager. So she wasn't immediately having children. So he really had to give up and just say, okay, well, it's going to be a female, and I guess it will go to my cousin Jane. And how much of a hand the Duke of Northumberland, Jane's father-in-law, had in that, I don't know if we'll ever know, but it seems really tidy and convenient to me.
Yes, it worked in his benefit
yes.
to have Jane instead of Mary. Okay, so all of this is happening. And then we have the Victorians, who seem to have a real fascination. Our generation is not the first to be fascinated with the Tudors.
No.
The Victorians were fascinated with the Tudors. And so one of the things you looked at is a novel, and it's William Harrison Ainsworth's novel, The Tower of London. So I put up a couple of pictures in my books with the Tower of London, because the tower itself is such an important structure in this time. And then the Victorians sort of reimagined the tower in this time. So can you talk to us about the novel and how that reflects Victorian thinking and what was kind of imagined about this time?
So I love the Victorian period for their love of the Tudors. Mm-hmm. And they really, through those 100 years or so, give or take, a long 19th century maybe, so many compendiums of sources were printed and made available that, you know, like, I still rely on them. Mm-hmm. Now, I can look back now and kind of criticize and say, well, they basically cut out all aspects of gender, and it's really hard to find the female voice. I mean, they weren't great at their editing, and they definitely chose to rely more heavily on kings, but there really were some interesting and still useful mm-hmm. groupings of sources put together. So this is how Underhill's memoir actually became really popular in the 19th century. So it was initially in the 16th century given to Fox to be put in his Book of Martyrs. Mm-hmm. And he chose not to use it. Because if you look at the story of Underhill, he's not your typical martyr. Right. Because he was a Protestant, but he kept his job. You know, mm-hmm. he served Mary. So Fox was like, yeah, you're not exactly the story that I want to include. So in the 19th century, when people were looking at Fox's papers and printing his sources and gathering them together, Underhill's memoir got grouped into, you know, this was still left in Fox's sources, and we're just going to print what we have. Well, this influences William Harrison Ainsworth, who really read a lot of those sources that were being printed. Mm-hmm. So one of his novels, like you said, was The Tower of London. He wrote it serially in 1840. So a bit came out each month for 12 months. Mm-hmm. And truly, the Tower of London itself is the main character of his novel.
Right.
So he has maps. He describes bits and pieces of the tower, what they look like, what they're used for. And he often breaks the fourth wall with his readers, mm-hmm. to his modern readers, and says, it is such a shame that you can't come in here and look at these parts of the tower because they're amazing. So this was really, at the time, parts of the tower were open to the public, but not others. Right. And his book really drove a fascination for the tower. And I even read that it was used as a history book until the mid 20th century to teach students, younger students, about what the tower was like. And then the stories that he told within the novel were kind of secondary, but it was really, really influential about the tower itself. Mm-hmm. But the time of the story is from Edward's death until Jane's execution in February of 1554. So it's about a 6 or 8 month period. And the novel tells the story of Jane and Mary, mm-hmm. and it only takes place at the tower. So most of it is fictionalized. But he did know his history, so he throws in bits like Edward Underhill and another guy named Gilbert Potter, who he mentions, who was the only person persecuted physically during Jane Grey's reign. So the day that Jane was proclaimed queen in London, he was working at a pub, and he said out loud, you know, no way, she's not queen, it's Mary. Well, he was arrested, mm-hmm. taken to the stocks, and his ears were cut off. And later, whenever Dudley and Northumberland was being taken to the tower, as he was arrested and Mary was proclaimed queen, Gilbert Potter was watching him walk down the streets and taunting him with a sword. But even mm-hmm. Ainsworth includes that in his novel. I mean, he was really well-read, historically.
Well, and that's really great because as we turn to some of those sources, though fictional, they can really give us a sense of the time. And something like that, mm-hmm. where someone was punished and then it turns out he was right and he comes up on top, you can really get a sense of that from a fictitious telling of what happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's really great. So we have, so how is Underhill depicted in that novel? How does he come across?
So the novel has 59 chapters and Underhill is in 3 of them.
Okay.
So he, in his earliest instance, it is whenever, I think it's whenever Jane is still queen. And Jane is in the tower, and Underhill comes to the tower to celebrate because he's friends with some of the people in the tower. So this is entirely fictional. He comes on his own, and he comes to preach about Protestantism. And isn't it great that Jane will now be a Protestant queen? So, and in the novel, they also call him the Hot Gospeler. So when he shows up, it's at this big party to celebrate Jane. And he walks in and they all roll their eyes like, oh, the buzzkill is here to talk about religion. You know, we can't this guy go away and go talk somewhere else? So that's our first instance with Underhill. Mm-hmm. And in our second instance with Underhill, Mary is now queen and she's in the tower getting ready for her coronation. Okay. So Underhill decides that he's going to assassinate her so that way Jane can still be queen.
Okay.
So Underhill kind of goes through this mental anguish of, should I assassinate Mary? What's the best plan of action? So he sees Mary walking down the hall, apparently as one would in the tower. And he says to her, you know, you need to give up Catholicism. You're totally wrong. You know, what are you doing? And she looks at him and feels bad for him and thinks he's demented and that he was an escaped prisoner from the tower. And she says, you know, give him some clothes, give him some food, and send him on his way. Okay. And he thinks to himself, well, I guess maybe she's not so bad. You know, like she didn't come off as a zealot or a bigot. Maybe she's not so bad. So as the novel progresses, which again is fictional, but as Mary's time progresses, she's often in the tower. And he decides, you know, I have to assassinate her. Everything is pointing towards Catholicism. I have to get rid of Mary. So he shoots her and he misses and he hits one of her guards instead. So he is now arrested and put in the tower for execution. And the last scene of the novel that he's in, he is being burnt at the stake in the tower, which did not happen, but was right. One another way that Ainsworth used historical figures or ways or one of his methods of writing was mm-hmm. foreshadowing things to come. So he used Underhill as a Protestant being burned to foreshadow the Marian burnings.
Okay.
So Underhill's character has a full character arc mm-hmm. and is open and closed in this novel.
All right. And that part is not reflective of actual history, but
right.
is used sort of as a tool for the novel to unfold its story. So I want to
yes.
pause for just a second now and talk a little bit about the tower, because
sure.
those of us who visit the tower and now you know, you go on the tours and you hear all the horror stories and you hear about executions and it's a scary place. But it's interesting that so much of the Jane Grey and Mary story, that early story, does take part, and that it's also, and I think we do forget this, it's also royal apartments. It's also
right.
where the monarch stays to get ready for the coronation. I mean, it's also this mm-hmm. really celebratory place. So tell us a little bit about the tower itself. And you mentioned it's a character in the novel. So tell us about that a little bit and help us see the tower in those ways.
I think you're right that sometimes when you go to the tower to visit now, they really do focus on the gore and the gruesome and you go see the rack, you know, at the bottom of the White Tower, and you see the glass where with the pillow where they executed the queens, even though that's not actually where they executed them. But, you know, you really mm-hmm. celebrate the gore and
right.
how the tower was a scary prison.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't help, too. You know, the yeoman warders are walking around and, you know, it reminds you that it is a living, working castle and it would have been a scary place. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. There were apartments there. There still are. I mean, the mm-hmm. yeoman warders live there, and they mm-hmm. live in those apartments that used to be, you know, where Anne Boleyn stayed the day before her coronation, or where Mary stayed the day before her coronation. I mean, Jane and Guildford were kept in the tower, but they weren't in the dingy dungeon of the tower. Right. You know, they had apartments, they had people, they had ladies, they had mm-hmm. servers, you know, but lots and lots of things happened at the tower. I mean, in it's true in the novel. So, but before Mary's coronation, she had entered London, she went and stayed in the tower for a few weeks, and it became a place of government and a place of business. Right. And it had so many functions. And that's one of the beauties of the novel, is it highlights all of those functions. So yes, it's a place of execution. Yes, it's a place of prison, but it's also a royal palace. And it's a mm-hmm. place where there's banquets and parties. And it's a place where there's royal apartments. And it's a place where the ambassadors, you know, talk in the corner and arrange Mary's marriage. I mean, so many things can happen at the tower. It has so many purposes.
Right. And I love that, because I think we've lost a little bit of that sometimes, you know, when you go in the yeoman warder tours, and they're wonderful. So I would never mean to criticize, but there is an aspect that they emphasize, and that is the more sensationalized prison aspect and execution aspect, and the most yes. recent execution in World War II prisoners were here. And that's what really often comes out. And so I love the idea that we can get a glimpse, and again, through Victorian eyes, we can get a glimpse of how much happened at the tower. So you have this novel where, do you think Ainsworth as a novelist is sympathetic to Mary? And what sort of drives that decision? Because we see Underhill coming down so strongly on the Protestant side, and the novel sort of, tell us a little bit about some of that anti-Mary, pro-Mary going on in the novel.
It does. It really does. And the novel is quirky. I mean, if you read it, or if a listener reads it, it is a quirky, quirky novel. I mean, there's giants in it that are the illegitimate sons of Henry VIII. I mean, there's a lot happening. But he is very interesting that for 1840, he is almost sympathetic to Mary. And he says this even in his preface. And as you read the novel, Ainsworth is very anti-extremism. And this was a big thing in the Victorian era, so it was more easily identified than maybe we would recognize it. But he was anti-extremism, both Catholic and Protestant. So he found issue with being somebody like Edward Underhill, the hot gospeler who comes in and just all Protestant all the time in your face. Mm-hmm. But he did not see Mary as Edward's antithesis. He actually saw Bishop Stephen Gardiner or the imperial ambassador Reynard as mm-hmm. the antithesis, as they are pushing Catholicism and return to the papacy. And Mary was somewhere in the middle. So okay. for the Mary that he writes is merciful. She gives Underhill a second chance. She doesn't want to execute Jane Grey. She accepts that the crown is her duty because her father was the king. And in many places, Ainsworth comments on her stoicism, mm-hmm. on her ability to rule that she inherited from her father. He said she is like Henry, and this was not, you know, this was meant as a compliment, right. not she's like Henry and, you know, it was, oh, she's like her father. She will be okay. She'll know what to do. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that he kind of uses her as the middle way of not to be extreme in either direction. And he got really panned for this after the novel came out. Mm. So he cited as his inspiration some of the newer works that were being done on the Tudors because of all those sources that were being reprinted by the Victorians. So he talks about Frederick Madden's privy purse expenses and how when you read them, you don't see Mary buying, you know, hatchets and poison. You read about her buying books and fabric and taking care of her sister and mm-hmm. giving gifts to her ladies. And it's mm-hmm. a different perspective. And he talks about some of those things and Martin Hume's work on the Tudors. And he says, you know, I really don't think we're getting the right picture of Mary, but, you know, were the burnings okay? No. And he leaves it as, I think we need to reconsider Mary. And a lot of critics immediately read this and said, no, you're totally wrong. She's Bloody Mary. You know, how did you miss this? So even Charles Dickens, who was one of his friends, wrote, you know, she will always be Bloody Mary. You know, you can't escape this. I don't even know why you tried. And he got, he also got panned for people who thought that his depiction of Underhill was done poorly. You know, that they were, that why didn't he understand Underhill as a Protestant martyr? Why did he make him this extremist? Mm-hmm. And Ainsworth really had to defend himself and his novel. So as a result, it didn't really get great reviews in the 19th century, but it did remain pretty popular. And I think it was because of the elements of the tower, not necessarily because of its depiction of Mary.
So that's interesting. And you mentioned it was those elements of the tower that so sort of carried it into the 20th century, right? Mm-hmm. As a resource about the tower, pushing the story maybe a little bit aside, but focusing on what he got right. Maybe, I don't know that I want to say right, but he did enhance our understanding of the tower.
He definitely did. And even in his novel, when he points out places like in the tower, so one of the places that's open now is one of the crypts, and you can go in there on your yeoman warder tours or by yourself and look around. Well, at the time, it was a place where they kept records. And in his novel, he says, can't they move these records somewhere else and let you see in this crypt? And he puts a whole scene in with Underhill and Gardner, and Gardner drags Underhill on his knees to mass and says, you know, can't you just be a Catholic already? And Underhill spits at the host and says, absolutely not. I'll go to my execution. And I think it's actually because of Ainsworth that some of those places became open. And became open to the public because he really advocated for, you know, the tower has all this great history and you need to be able to come see it.
Well, that's really interesting. And you mentioned early on that the tower is a character, maybe one of the main characters. And so certainly as a cheerleader in some ways for the tower and for people being able to visit those then closed, now open spaces in the tower. So that, if we think about it, the idea that we can go into so many parts of the tower and see so much is quite remarkable. And, you know, he may have had something to do with that. So
I think he did. And then, you know, for me or for other people who are interested in the Tudors, it's an interesting novel. Mm-hmm. You know, it did so many things. It really promoted the tower, but it gives you a Victorian perspective of the Tudors when all of these sources were becoming available. So it was really like you could know so much more about the Tudors. And this is just what one guy did with, you know, everything that was coming out that you could learn.
Right. So would you say overall, and you mentioned that he was sort of panned for his more sympathetic portrayal of Mary. And I've read that in some of the Victorian sentiment, maybe is the best way, that it's Lady Jane Grey who is traditionally the more sympathetic character when you look at those two women. And we talked about this for that 2-week-ish period, it's impossible to sort of pull them apart. Their stories are intertwined so completely. My sense is that Lady Jane tends to come out a little more sympathetically in many Victorian depictions. Is that accurate or am I just seeing a slice of that?
I think that is accurate. I'm not super well versed in Victorian things, but some of this has to do with the Stricklands, which I'm sure, they were incredibly important. They mention Underhill in their biography about Mary.
Okay.
And it had to do, I think, with larger Victorian ideas of domesticity and women had a role in the house. And in many ways, Jane fulfilled that. She got married. She had a husband. She did what her parents told her to do. You know, she was what all of the Victorians hoped their daughters would be. She was the woman who, you know, she was the daughter who followed the directions and was docile and was pious all at the same time. And Mary didn't quite fit those. She, you know, initially she ruled without a husband. She didn't always agree with her counsel. Okay. And it was easier to be slightly more sympathetic to Jane, who they could model to fit those Victorian ideas, and then who was executed for exhibiting them. So it was much easier to write Jane as a sympathetic figure than it was Mary.
Okay. So then let's sort of look ahead to more recent scholarship on Mary and Jane, but Mary in particular, because there have been some really great new ways of looking at Mary, I think, that really open our eyes to a fuller picture of her. So how can we see her now, or what are some of the ways now that in particular, just this remarkable behavior during this period of time that she exhibits as people flock to her, and how she gets that so right? She just seems to have a sense of what to do.
I think you're right. In the last 30 years, and maybe even in the last 15 particularly, there has been some really wonderful work on Mary, and more well-rounded. So we've moved away from only talking about the burnings and her religion to other things that she accomplished, to things like culture, music, things that maybe have been applied, or methodologies that have been applied to Henry VIII and Elizabeth.
Right.
And to give you a full picture of their reign and life are now being applied to Mary. Like, yes, we can look at her as an important international queen. You know, not only was she queen of England, but sometimes you forget she was queen of Spain and Naples and lots of other places through her marriage. So you can look at her now as finding a place within Europe and being a very important piece of that. And look at the different ways that she ruled and how she ran her household. And even just with her accession with Jane, how they both reacted very differently, but how Mary had this great affinity and this great network. And she was able to call upon all of these people to, you know, come rally to her and serve her, because she was the daughter of Henry VIII and she had proven herself worthy. And even to move forward a little bit right before Jane's execution with Wyatt's Rebellion, and Mary gives that great speech at Blackfriars, you know, I am the mother of the people. And, you know, I've never been married and I don't have kids, but I imagine my feelings for you are what a mother feels for her children. And she really gets a lot right. And sometimes we forget to look at that. And in some ways, which is ironic, you can blame places like the Tower, where when you go there and they talk about the Tudors, she is still Bloody Mary.
Yes.
And that perception doesn't go away. You know, so no matter what academic historians say about Mary and try to give you a new image of her life and reign and education and humanism and patronage, you still go to one of those public places like Hampton Court or the Tower and she's Bloody Mary. And it's very hard to fight against that.
So that was my next question. Why is it that that idea or image continues? And I was thinking particularly at the Tower, because it is, you know, such a part of London, right? It's just right there in the middle of London. And London was so important to Mary. And the Tower was important to Mary. And it has now come to represent something different, or its representation of Mary is so complicated. And so what role does the Tower play in our understanding and misunderstanding of Mary as we go on?
I think places like the Tower or some of the really popular tourist places, they still rely in some ways on stereotypes, because that's what is easy to digest. You know, so it's wonderful to think of, you know, good Queen Bess and, you know, old Hal, and think of all of those and then just, well, and compare that to Bloody Mary, you know, so it's very easy to just fall into those old stereotypes and tropes where Elizabeth was amazing and her sister was not. And that's so much easier to explain history that way, instead of being more nuanced, especially especially when you might only be at the tower for an hour or 45 minutes and you're only reading bits and pieces. And, you know, they're not going to put big, long, nuanced explanations. It's much easier to be like, okay, let's list the Tudors and here's Henry, you know, the boy king, Bloody Mary, and mm-hmm. Gloriana. And it's just easy to fall into those stereotypes and not necessarily explain them away or give a new image. And I really hope that some of the public history starts to follow this newest work on Mary. And I think, too, she suffers because she was only queen for 5 years.
Right.
Because in many ways, Edward is ignored, too. And not for the same reason, but he is. You know, they're the mid-Tudors that they just didn't reign long enough to get some of the big accomplishments or big reputations that the father and Elizabeth have.
Right.
You know, so in many ways, it's easy to forget the two of them together or just mention them in passing to get to the really big accomplishments of Henry and Elizabeth.
Right. It's as if, and I was going to mention that, it's as if we get all this talk about Henry VIII, and then there are the other two, and then we get to Elizabeth, and the other two are just kind of as different as Edward and Mary were. They're kind of lumped together almost.
Yes.
As just the holding ground before we get to Elizabeth.
Absolutely.
And you do see, I think, much as I love going to the tower, I think you do see some of that. And it's almost as if some of those Victorian ideas are still, you know, those stories are still the ones that you're hearing almost. So you've mentioned some of the ways the tower was important to Mary, some of the ways that London's important to Mary. So as you think about, and I know you've done a lot of work on queenship and just some wonderful, you know, asking questions, which is so important. So if we were to sort of look at this novel and the idea of Victorian sort of opening some of these records up and presenting them, making them available, they had their own slant on things, but these records became available, which is a really wonderful way of opening up discussion and allowing different kinds of questions. So what do you think now, as we move forward, as we think about Jane Grey and Mary, these two women in this particular time, what are some of the questions you think we should keep thinking about and keep asking moving forward about Jane and Mary and this period of time that gets glossed over sometimes? What should we be looking for? What should we be asking about?
I think, first and foremost, that we should be able to think about Mary and Jane in a couple ways. So that is together. Their stories are tied together. You cannot take them apart at the accessions.
Right.
But in many ways, they were very different. So one was bred to be a queen from her childhood. Yep. Now, Jane had an excellent education. She was very well read. They were very similar, but very different. And I think it's important as we move forward to even ask some of those questions. How were they similar? Why would people have supported Jane? Why would people have supported Mary? And why wouldn't they have supported these two? And get a more nuanced understanding besides some of the immediate political events that were happening in London. Mm-hmm. What was the perception around England for these two? Right. And even what was the international perception? Because this had a big international fallout, or it could have.
It could have.
You know, Mary as the cousin of the Holy Roman Emperor.
Right.
If she wouldn't have become queen, what could have happened? So it's important to not always think about England so insularly, but to think about the bigger picture of why the events of July 1553 were so important.
Yes.
And then to follow through, I think sometimes, you know, Jane's story kind of ends as Mary's begins. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think it's really important to think about those first 6 months of Mary's reign, because sometimes looking back, we pull out some of those highlights of her reign, for good or for bad, and we ignore some of the other parts of her reign, or we only see it maybe as tragic or inevitable or terrible or bloody. But for the year between July 1553 and July 1554, when she married Philip, she was incredibly popular.
Right.
She was respected. She was effective. And it's really only once Philip comes to England and marries her that July, 1 year later, that perceptions of Mary mm-hmm. get tied to Philip, to the Black legend, to, oh my goodness, what are we going to do because of Catholicism and the Pope and the Empire? Mm-hmm. And that's even now, we don't understand that as well as we could, because so many people have so often relied on those stereotypes. So I think it's really important to look at Mary's first year.
Right.
And what she did as a queen, and not always just focus on the bad things or mm-hmm. Things that went wrong.
Right. And you mentioned, and I think this is one of the things that we do overlook, that her response to the Wyatt Rebellion, and her ministers were trying to get her out of London, and she refused to leave London because she knew that's where she needed to be. And that speech she gave, all of that was so powerful, and people responded to her so strongly with such devotion, and that gets so overlooked, right?
It really does. The first year of her reign gets so overlooked when you immediately think of burnings, and she mm-hmm. didn't have kids, mm-hmm. and her marriage to Philip was a failure, and she lost Calais, and you kind of focus on those things and you forget about that whole first year, or the fact that for the 4 years she was married to Philip, he was in England less than one.
Right.
You know, like yeah. he wasn't there ruling over her, mm-hmm. you know, over her shoulder, even though that's kind of the perception that, you know, she marries Philip and just becomes some shrinking violet or something right. who mm-hmm. only listens to his advice. And, you know, it's really different and fights against some of those stereotypes.
Right. And the way she had that marriage agreement spell out limitations that were right. new. I mean, for a royal marriage, she saw things in a whole new way. For a coronation of a ruling queen, she saw things in a whole new way. And that just kind of gets overlooked sometimes. And I think going forward, that's really important. So that's great. That's great. All right. So just finally, so we've had looking back, we've looked at some Victorian version. We start with Edward, and he'd been, I just think it's so interesting. If you think of, here's a man who was like a professional courtier in a way, right? He serves Henry, he serves Edward, he serves Jane, he serves Mary, he goes into Elizabeth's reign, right? So we have mm-hmm. this sense of the very professional courtier, the professional worker at court. In that time, in the Tudor time, then the way the Victorians sort of looked again at the Tudors, and in this novel, which is so interesting, at this character and changed him, you know, sort of retold his story. And then we talked a little bit about how we can look at this and gain so much. And through it all, there's London and the Tower in particular in London. So as you think about the impact of the Tudors, and a lot of us find ourselves just so fascinated, as the Victorians were, and the Tudor fascination continues. Do you have a sense of why or what we are continuing to learn from the Tudors? Because I think we do continue to learn. I'll just put it out there. My view is we continue to learn from the Tudors, even though we've talked about them for a long time and we talk about them a lot. So do you think we're continuing to learn from the Tudors? And if so, what do you think we still have to learn from them?
I think we absolutely do still learn from the Tudors. I mean, I don't see myself stopping my fascination with them anytime soon. And, you know, all of my colleagues and friends who study the Tudors, I think it's the same. You know, I think mm-hmm. we all have a fascination and we're not going anywhere. And I'm certain there are so many other people who are the same way. You know, you can't get enough of going to the sites or reading the books mm-hmm. or reading the blogs or looking at mm-hmm. things online. I mean, the fascination is there. And I think it's for so many reasons, and we still have so much we can learn about the Tudors, because, you know, thanks to the Victorians, we got a very male gendered view of the Tudors for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And now we're really starting to learn more about queenship and getting a vastly different gendered idea about the Tudors. And I think that's awesome. But then I think there's other things we can learn about the Tudors too. And to me, the most logical next place seems to be is transnational. So when I think about mm-hmm. Mary, I'm starting to think about wider issues of transnational. So not just Mary as Queen of England, mm-hmm. but Mary as a small piece of Europe and what mm-hmm. that meant. So for me, there's that aspect that we can continue to learn about the Tudors and even pulling in more Spanish sources.
Right.
So like when Mary dies, many of her ladies go to live in Spain. Some of them married Spaniards. There's so many sources and books in Spain.
Right.
That, you know, if we could merge the Spanish scholarship on Philip and Mary with the English scholarship on Philip and Mary, there would be something, you know, there's something really exciting lurking there. I think other aspects are more interdisciplinary. So I think it's really exciting. Some of the new work that will be on history, literature, and art, all kind of in combination, where some of those fields used to be very separate. Right. And now you have people, and I'm hoping I'm one of them, that kind of bring a lot of those aspects together and what you can learn when you merge multiple fields or look at different sources or look at really familiar sources, some of these Victorian printed sources in a new way, when you're not just reading them for narrative, but when you look at them in a new way. And that's why I think there's so much still we can do with the Tudors. There's no need to stop.
Okay. Well, that's great, because we're not stopping, right?
No, we're not. I'm absolutely not.
Okay. Well, that is great. And I'm thinking even, you know, this novel that tells us so much about the Tower. I mean, that's just one example of a whole different way of sort of looking at the way the Tower was used in these rooms and all of that through a novel. We haven't always looked to novels to gain an that's just a novel kind of thing. And so the architecture and the art and all of that. So you are right. And that is, it's a wonderful and a lot of exciting discoveries ahead, I'm sure. And we do continue to learn and find new things all the time. So thank you, Valerie, so much for joining me. This has been such a treat to get to know you better and to get to see the impact of some of your scholarship and get to know these familiar figures that it turns out maybe we didn't know as well as we thought, and particularly Mary and Jane during this time in July where they were both vying for the throne. In some ways, just the idea that there are two women vying for the throne and that all eight of the possible heirs are women. There's something really kind of great there too, you know.
There really is.
Would not have liked that.
But. No, but it's a wonderful time to think about.
Yeah.
You know, just there's so much still to think about. And even when you put something just as simple as, you know, all eight heirs were women, it really gives you a different perspective of what was happening and makes you think about things differently.
Makes you think about things differently. But, and that's how we learn. We start thinking about things differently. So thank you so much for sharing your time, your expertise, your insight and brilliance with us. And thank you everyone for listening. Now tell us where we can find you, follow your work, maybe what you're working on next.
So you can find me at Tudor Queenship on Instagram, and my website is tudorqueenship.com. So you can find publications and projects and that kind of stuff. I'm working on several things right now, which is not surprising. I usually get myself in over my head because I love the Tudors so much. So I'm writing a biography of Anne of Cleves, more of a cultural biography. So I'm including elements of art and architecture and culture into her biography. I'm editing some books on Mary. So one is, I will hopefully come out later this year, on Mary and Jane Grey's Accessions. Another is on myths about the Tudors, and another is on Mary and humanism. Mm. So I'm really interested in lots and lots of different, you know, a variety of aspects of queenship for the Tudors.
That's wonderful. And I will have the links with all of your handles and your website and everything on there so we can continue to follow. And I'm hoping, I definitely want to talk about that Anne of Cleves and all the other stuff you're doing, but I am definitely looking forward to that Anne of Cleves book. She's another one I think we overlook, and there's a lot to learn there. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you everyone for listening. I appreciate it. And we will see you all again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you would be so kind, I would love it if you would share with a friend, or perhaps leave a rating, and maybe even consider becoming a patron. In any case, I hope you join us again soon as we shake up history together.